A podcast of the cinema.
Good morning. Good Tuesday morning to you, Alonzo Duralde, who is my husband and also the film reviews editor of The Wrap, and also the co-host of Who Shot Ya, and also the co-host of Breakfast All Day.
And good morning to you, Dave White, film critic for The Wrap, and busy person.
I'm a very busy person.
You are.
I'm also... Okay, well, first of all, people need to know that we fixed our technical difficulty.
We did.
We don't know how we fixed it.
No.
I certainly didn't fix it.
It happened, and...
And then it unhappened.
Let's just be happy about that.
What was... there was... Your computer was not communicating
it wasn't
to the
It wasn't acknowledging the that there was a soundboard plugged into it.
Apparently, the sound on my mic dropped out halfway through Linoleum Nights.
Oh, I didn't
Which is a different podcast that we do. We can explain it later if you don't know what that is. And then that was the beginning of our doom.
I guess so. So yeah, so there was that, and then you are not sick anymore, but
I was coughing a lot. When the thing got fixed, I was having a weird coughing jag, and I thought, I can't talk and do this at the same time.
Yeah.
So then that pushed us back further. And now here we are again. Aren't you happy?
On a Tuesday morning.
Everyone's happy now that we're here. We're back, everyone.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
I missed you. I missed you. I like us this way. I missed you.
Can I borrow him for a minute?
Dave is making me watch The
we're
Bachelor.
We're here for the right reasons. I just want to tell you right
insane.
Now.
Insane. The grammar alone on that show.
It's a very bad show. The Bachelor.
Oh.
But I gotta, you know what? I gotta see this season out. I don't usually watch The Bachelor. I watch The Bachelorette.
Because you like to watch men suffer.
I like to watch men suffer. But I gotta tell you, watching The Bachelor is a whole different kind of experience because you get to see a very specific kind of woman in a group behaving horrifically. This is my first season watching The Bachelor, and I'm only doing it because I think Colton is gay and is going to come out by the end of the by the end of the season.
I think,
or after the season's over, after he rejects all the girls and then comes out in the tabloids or something, like so that it doesn't smell up the show with weird gayness. Because that's listen. There's no rules on The Bachelor other than you can't be gay, and I think The Bachelor's gay this season.
He might be.
I got no proof. It's just a gut feeling.
Lots of
I
hunches.
Have.
Yeah. I suspect one of the producers like was a Mooney or something because they really there's a lot of cult tactics. On
oh yeah,
there
really are. The whole like get you exhausted and in this frenzied group dynamic, and then
no sleep,
and then no sleep, and then a lot of wine.
Yeah,
so many wine glasses just being.
Glug, 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 glug.
Cranked back on that show.
Anyway, more on that.
I'm in a very bad mood in spite of what we were just talking about because we just woke up. Not woke up. I mean, like, I've been awake for 6 hours. But the...
breaking news this morning.
Jussie Smollett of Empire was queer bashed in Chicago.
Yes.
In a...
It was both racist and homophobic.
And Trumpish.
Yes.
They were wearing MAGA hats. Or no, they were wearing ski masks.
They yelled, "This is MAGA
country." And they yelled,
"This
is MAGA country."
After beating him, putting a noose around his neck, and pouring bleach on him.
Yes.
So if we want to talk about intersectionality, this one just has everything.
Yeah.
It's horrifying, and it's 2019, and I'm upset about it.
Are you a MAGA person who just happens to be stumbling onto this podcast? Go away. You're not allowed to listen to this podcast. You're not our friend.
You don't deserve it.
Beat it. And I am feeling very eye for an eye right now about this. Like, I know the justice system is supposed to take care of this, but, like, I just really want to go kill these people.
Well,
I want to kill them. I'm feeling murderous, and I'm feeling rage-filled, and that's how I feel right now. And they deserve everything they did to him and worse.
I think you're maybe in the anger phase.
I am. I stay in that phase quite a bit.
Yeah. I'm
just in life in general.
I'm upset. Like, I feel this in my chest, you know, and you know, yes, I've never met this person, but the fact that something like this can happen in 2019 in this country is horrifying. And it's a reminder that, like, wealth and privilege and power will not protect you.
And visibility does not protect queer people.
No.
It makes our lives better in the long run and in general.
But it also makes us targets.
But it makes us targets as well. And so... yeah, I'm filled with murderous rage right now. I have no happy ending to this conversation.
No.
Or ray of hope. I'm just furious.
No.
So I hope they catch them. I hope there were some surveillance cameras.
Ditto.
I hate surveillance culture in general. I don't like the fact that there are cameras everywhere you go now.
Mm-hmm. But hey, if they're there.
But hey, if they're there, I hope they picked these up. I hope they picked up these guys.
Yeah.
And if you are the people who know these people and they start bragging about it, I hope you...
turn them into the authorities.
Turn them in so that they can be brought to me for vigilante street justice. I'll happily dispense it. But this is a film podcast.
Yes.
We're not talking about The Bachelor.
No.
We're not talking about... disgusting MAGA people who beat the hell out of other people. We are talking about the current cinema.
Yes.
Now, we are in a narrow window this week.
Yes.
We have to make this a very 60-minute podcast. Normally, we go over. We stretch out.
Yeah.
We elongate. We go as long as we please.
We gamble.
But you have an appointment this afternoon.
Yes.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
I don't know. So maybe we'll just not talk about it yet.
Somebody fancy wants to put Alonzo Duraldi on camera, so... What else is new?
More on that when it becomes a thing that I can talk about.
You getting paid for this?
No.
Ugh.
This is worth it.
I guess.
Before
Listen, I don't get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day.
I know. Linda Evangelista.
That was Linda Evangelista. Yeah.
No, this is, I'm building the brand, damn it.
Me too. With murderous rage.
That's your brand.
This is my brand.
Indeed. Before we get into the current cinema, though, I did want to mention the passing of a cinema giant. Michel Legrand just died. And he's one of those people where you go through his IMDb page, you're like, oh my God, he did that? Oh God, oh yeah, I forgot he did that. He is one of, he's a legendary composer, you know, did a lot of great musicals like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort and Yentl.
I posted a picture of Catherine Deneuve and Françoise Dorléac in their hats.
Of course.
From Young Girls on Instagram. And only one person knew what I was doing. Only one person, like, comment-wise acknowledged that. I don't know.
I'm sure many others knew.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a guy who got started with the French New Wave. Like, he did a lot of the early Godard films, including his quote-unquote musical, A Woman is a Woman.
That was not a musical.
Well, it's a deconstructed musical.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, Legrand's contributions are vital to that. He was working with Jacques Demy all the way back at Lola. He did the score for Cleo from 5 to 7. And then more recently, you know, he did a film we love, La Bûche.
Yeah.
He did Daisy von Schurlemeyer's Madeleine movie from the 90s.
Yep.
And up to last year, he did the score for the rest restoration of Orson Welles's The Other Side of the Wind. He pops up in the final cut for Orson documentary, rather.
Yeah.
Talking about that. And, you know, he had worked with Welles previously on F for Fake. He wrote The Windmills of Your Mind and The Summer Knows and, like, these really sort of classic, you know, late 60s, early 70s film songs. Anyway, he was a legend. He is no more. But
The Summer Knows is a jam.
I love that song. Like, back when AOL used to have an easy listening, there was AOL Radio, and they had an easy listening channel, and I was totally down for that. this thing, it popped up. It was a version of The Summer Nose by a singer I'd never heard of named Laura Fiji, F-Y-G-I,
right. Yeah.
Who's apparently like a Dutch cabaret singer. And she did an entire album of Michel Legrand covers called Watch What Happens, and I highly recommend it. And, you know, go back and watch Yentl, go back and watch Young Girls of Rochefort. He was a genius. Sadly, now we must move on to movies that opened in January.
Glass.
Yeah.
Glass.
Glass.
I saw Unbreakable.
Uh-huh.
And then I saw Split.
Yes.
And I remember seeing Unbreakable way back in the day and reviewing it and thinking, yeah, wow, this is a cool movie. I like this movie. What a cool movie. And then the ending came along. And I thought, I don't like this movie anymore.
Now, did you not like it because of the whole comic book kind or because it ended before the actual expected climax?
Yeah. All right. It's a good film.
Uh-huh.
That I wasn't smart enough to see when I first saw The Goodness. When I first saw it, I wasn't smart enough to see The Goodness.
I see.
I didn't understand comic books enough. Obviously, I'd been hanging out with you for plenty of years, but your comic book nerdism is something that I've always just, you know, I give you a pat on the head and say, that's nice, dear, and then and you
move
go
on. Yes.
Yeah. And so when the movie did it to me, I just thought, what's going on? I don't know. And then I got over it.
Uh-huh.
You know, later I realized, okay, well, I get it now. He ended it that way because that's the comic book way to end things. Okay, so. Then I saw Split, which I didn't like at all.
Mm-hmm.
From start to finish.
Right.
But then the ending comes along, and you learn, oh no, we're in the Unbreakable universe. And here's how it's all connected to Unbreakable. And I did this in the press screening. Why? All that to say this. I didn't see Glass, and I'm not gonna.
Well, I had...
Continue. Please, take the mic. Rock the mic. Explain Glass to everybody.
I had the opposite experience in that I had not seen Unbreakable or Split, but then had to see them in order to see Glass for Who Shot Ya. The end of Split sets us up for a sequel tying those two movies together. And indeed, we return to David Dunn, Bruce Willis's character, you know, who 19 years later is still a superpowered vigilante on the streets of Pittsburgh.
In a rain poncho,
who somehow over the course of nearly two decades has like never been photographed or apprehended or captured or seen or anything.
Right.
And has been dubbed the Overseer by the press.
Now, that's not a bad superhero name.
It's pretty crappy.
Why is it crappy?
Because it sounds...
I'm into it.
For one thing, for me, it just brings back... It calls back The Plantation. Like...
Oh, yeah.
You know...
You did that... I used that word once in conversation with you, and it might have even been on this podcast. And you were like, no, that's not the right word to use, because that's Plantation era speak. And yeah. I was like... And I said the same thing I said just now. Oh, yeah. Like, it leaves my brain that word has those connotations.
So that, and then also, I think it was Nathan Rabin who jokingly said, like, what's his catchphrase going to be? You've been overseen! You know.
I have checked and balanced you.
Exactly. Anyway, so he sets out to find the Horde, which is James McAvoy's character.
Right, because now he's got, like, twice as many personalities this movie as it did last time.
No. They go from in Split. They go from 23 to 24, and the 24th one is the Beast, which is the superhuman, strong, crazy one.
But we don't get to see all 24 in Split.
We don't.
Right.
We see a bunch more in this one though, because James McAvoy he left some scenery unchewed in the last movie.
He's got license.
Oh,
these films give him license to do the thing that you really don't want actors to do.
No.
Which is go hog wild.
Ham it up.
Unless, you know, it's in the service of a really amazing...
juicy screenplay.
Such as Mommy Dearest or Showgirls, something like that, where the character... It's one person going berserk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, they get captured by Sarah Paulson, who is a psychiatrist who specializes in people with delusions that they are superheroes. She brings them to the same psychiatric facility where they've been holding Samuel L. Jackson all this time for the crimes that he perpetrated in Unbreakable. And, you know, she's trying to convince them all that it's all in their heads, that they're not really superheroes, that this is just this thing they've made up. And she tries to provide sort of rational explanations behind what happened to them and how things happen and blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, because this is an M. Night Shyamalan movie, there's a twist, which I won't go into. Maybe sometimes we are
going to spoil the hell out of Serenity, though, at the end of this episode.
Do we have time? I was thinking that we might do a separate episode this week where we just spoil Glass and Serenity.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, because we're in kind of a hurry today, unfortunately.
Okay, maybe.
So we'll come back to that. But anyway, seeing Unbreakable for the first time in 2019 is a very different experience, because in 2000, comic books had not bled into the popular mainstream culture the way they have now.
Correct.
And so you could...
They were there,
but you could talk about comics in a way...
We weren't drowning in it like we are now.
Right. You could talk about comics in a way where, like, okay, I got to explain this to some of y'all in the back because you're not going to know this, you know?
Right.
And the idea...
That was me.
And the idea that you're going to tell a superhero story in a way that is super, like, dour and blue-collar and, you know, not, you know, primary colored in any way, I'm sure at the time felt daring and revolutionary. But now, like, they make all kinds of superhero movies in all kinds of ways. And, you know, we've had Logan, you know, we've had other stuff. So, you know, it's like trying to watch, we talked about this on Who's Shy, it's like trying to watch Psycho for the first time now.
Yes.
It's never going to have that impact that it had if you were one of the people that saw it in 1960. Split is terrible. And somehow the victim of Split manages to come back for this movie, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who is full of compassion for the, like, nice identities locked into James McAvoy, even though she was the victim of the mean ones in the previous film. I just found this kind of dumb, and the twists are, the twists, I don't even know if they work or not, because so much else in the movie doesn't make any sense. Like, the psychiatric hospital is so slipshod and so poorly managed. You're like, well, is this part of the scheme, or is this just bad writing? Like, I don't know.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. So,
and at the end, how does it look like? Does it look like it was bad writing or part of the scheme?
That's the thing. You don't know until after the twist. And then, you're like, well, wait. But then how come? But
right.
Does that mean, were they, was it supposed to be?
I have questions now.
Yep. Exactly. So, yeah.
Let's do an extra episode where we talk about these two films and spoil them.
Okay.
So that I can know the twist, because I don't know that twist yet.
Okay. I'll tell you everything later. So you brought up Serenity. You wanted to explain that one?
Okay. Matthew McConaughey is a fisherman mm-hmm. who lives on an island.
Mm-hmm.
He has a ridiculous name, Baker Dill.
Baker Dill. In Bibbs' review for The Wrap, he calls him Baker Dill at, like, every reference point. I thought it was very funny.
I don't know where this island is, but everyone is very sweaty, especially Matthew McConaughey. And he aggravates his sweatiness by having daily... sexual romps with Diane Lane.
Yes.
Who is always wearing like an ill-fitting Diane von Furstenberg wrap dress.
Yes. No matter how...
Even in the middle of sex.
No matter how muggy and sex-sweaty everybody gets, she's got that thing wrapped around her body.
And so... And she's always talking about how she wants him to find her cat. Which, in the context of this film, which is essentially a 90s erotic thriller.
Kind of, yeah.
Brought into 2019. It sounds real dirty when she talks about him. She wants him to find her kitty. So
it's kind of, you know, it's like, you know, Matthew McConaughey.
And then you see that.
If she makes that request to you every time after you have sex, she's trying to tell you something.
Well, no, she's not, because she's clearly having a whale of a time with him.
True, yes. And there is a cat.
They don't. And there's a literal cat you see wandering around. Okay, we're getting into the weeds here.
Very easy to do with this movie.
Anne Hathaway. There's a lot of weeds.
So many weeds.
In this movie. Anne Hathaway is a woman who shows up like this.
Yes. She's wearing the Kathleen Turner from Body Heat collection.
Uh-huh.
It's all wide-brimmed hats and trench coats and...
How's it going, Baker Dill? Long time. I want you to kill my husband. Okay, so her husband is played by Jason Clarke.
Yeah.
Which is like, he's becoming the Danny Houston of now, like, where every movie he's in, you're like,
an a-hole.
He's the worst person and should be killed. Yeah. And then you learn over the course of time that that Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey were a thing before, and not only were they a thing, they had a kid.
Right.
And for this particular episode, that's all I'm going to tell you. But I will tell you that there is a surprise halfway through this movie that is so, even though no one's going to see this film, and it will take a long time for people to understand the legendary stupidity of this movie, there's a legendarily stupid surprise in the middle of this film.
It is such a Pandora's box
right.
in terms of like, whoa.
Yeah. I want to encourage...
If this is true, then what about this and this and this?
What about this other? Oh!
Ew!
Yeah. And so... I want to say that everyone should go see this movie before it leaves theaters. And it's going to leave theaters in about 3 minutes. So, like, they're probably going to stop the screening that they have right now because no one has bought a ticket in 4 days.
I mean...
Because it's making zero money.
Yeah.
And everyone hates it.
Only bad movie. It's like the Book of Henry. Like, only bad movie enthusiasts are running out to see it because they...
Yes.
Because of reviews like this one.
Yes. You all know who you are if this is your kind of bad movie.
Yeah. If you rushed out to see Oogie Loves on the big screen.
It's the first one of its kind of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And very much worth sneaking into after you buy a ticket to a better film that needs... Go buy a ticket to If Beale Street Could Talk.
There you go.
And then go see Beale Street Could Talk.
Then sneak
into this. I really can't wait to talk about all of the surprises and because the more you know about the surprise, the dumber this movie gets.
Yes, the more quicksand it sinks into. And this is from Stephen Knight, who wrote and directed a movie we love, Locke, which was also, one might call it a gimmicky movie in that it's all Tom Hardy in a car on the phone. But that movie's brilliant, and this movie is bananas.
Right.
And I wish it were...
I'm a supporter.
I wish it were... This. I wish its bananasness were more fun.
Oh, I had a lot of fun.
But, yeah, it is... You do
I
have to...
I was having fun with you. Don't go alone and see it, because then there's no one to talk to. And you'll be able to talk out loud in the theater.
Because it will be empty, there with
you. You can live tweet it, probably, if you want to. There won't be anyone else around.
But please don't give away the surprise. Because
go ahead. Go ahead and give away the surprise when you live tweet it while you're alone in the theater. Who cares? So,
But yeah, it is such an archetypal, like, crappy noir film. When she pops up, like, I want you to kill my terrible rich husband. It's like...
Right.
Brother, like there's an entire Stan Ridgway album of this kind of stuff, you know.
Nice obscure 80s music reference
yes,
there.
Well, thank you. But you know, it is like this is how every noir film starts. And Matthew McConaughey is just like
dripping with oils, yeah.
Howling at the moon, literally howling into the sky.
Oh, he screams into the sky about 5 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, shows the butt a lot.
Oh, it's a thrusty butt, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's a thrusty sex butt that he has.
But you get thrusty
sex
butt.
And he's like a producer or something
you get
on the
thrusty
movie,
sex
so like
butt,
he's
you,
into you, showing you, his thrusty sex
you
butt.
You also get like pensive top of the cliff butt. Like there's a lot of different varieties.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
Oof.
Y'all go see it. It's just rock stupid. The kid, who would be king?
Not a sequel to The Man Who Would Be King.
It is not. Why don't you tell people what it what even is it?
What even is it? Okay, so this is Joe Cornish's long-awaited follow-up to Attack the Block. And it stars Louis Sherborne Serkis, the son of Andy Serkis.
Yes.
As a regular run-of-the-mill, sort of runty, bullied kid, British schoolboy. one day while running from bullies, he stumbles into a construction site where he finds a sword and a stone, pulls it out. It's that sword and that stone. And he soon learns when Merlin shows up that he is indeed the once and future king and must rally his forces to battle the wizard Morgana, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who plans her revenge after the original Arthur put her under the ground. And lessons are learned, and kids are rallied, and yeah, it's basically, it's a kind of a fun Neo Camelot.
Oh, I not once did I think of Neo Camelot while viewing this film.
I don't mean Camelot the musical. I mean just in terms of the Arthur legend.
Okay, well, that's what I always think of, though. I think of the musical. So. There's a type of children's film that I really am into.
Yeah.
This kind. Where normal kids, not polished kid actors.
Yeah.
But normal acting, normal kids.
Yeah. And who aren't like the special one. You know?
Right. No one's the special one in this movie. Except, I mean, he is the special one, but he's not.
But not by birth or by legacy or any of that stuff.
Right. He's by. It's on accident, yeah, really.
Purely randomly.
And when I was a child, watching films where kids got to band together communally,
uh-huh,
and fight an evildoer,
mm-hmm,
like the bad, you know, the man trying to tear down the community center. Yeah, yeah, something, yeah, like that. Those got me so amped up as a kid, because I was myself the kind of kid who was kind of like a loner, and you know, and what I always dreamed of was
being part of a pack,
being part of a kid gang, and we would, you know, do justice for things, you know, and so
the little rascals,
kinda, yeah. When a film can take this energy and be rousing and make you as an 8 or 9 year old feel like you're going to leave that theater, you're going out and going to go do something great with your gang of other kids. That's the kind of movie this is. I think fewer people are actually going to see it than Serenity.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer.
Yeah, buy a ticket to this maybe and sneak into Serenity.
Yeah.
If not, if Beale Street could talk.
If you have kids, take them. Because
professional mom Christy Lemire says little kids might be scared by the like flaming dead, you know, knights on horseback.
I think I might disagree, because I remember seeing Bedknobs and Broomsticks,
mm-hmm,
when I was young. And that movie had, you know,
Nazis
and ghosts in knight's armor.
Uh-huh.
And none of that scared me. I was ready, you know, with my Bedknob and Broomstick gang to like beat the Nazis. So who knows? Nick is not too young.
Nick was fine.
Yeah.
But she was thinking just in terms of like 6, 7 year olds might be, you know. I don't know. People will ask you sometimes, like, was this okay for an 8 year old? I'm like, I don't know.
Yes, everything's okay for an 8 year old. Didn't one of our friends, when he was like 8 or 9, his parents were like, oh, you want to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Sure. And
probably.
Yeah. I know it happened to him at a very young age, and he just was into it, and it became, you know, horror became his life.
Well, yeah. April Wolf always talks about her grandparents showing her horror movies at a far too young age.
Right.
You know, and yeah, you know, it would have freaked me out at that age. I mean,
right,
like, I didn't watch Jaws until I was in college.
You're a special case.
I'm a soft boy.
You are. You're made of little cakes. Just a mound of them. Mound of little cakes.
It's true. My blood type is angel food.
I think, what's this kid's name? Angus Imrie?
Angus Imrie, yes, as young Merlin.
Young Merlin is...
hilarious.
And then Patrick Stewart...
as old Merlin.
As old Merlin. Like, both Merlins
yeah.
are delightful.
They both kind of steal the movie.
So you are... you are commissioned to go see this, buy a ticket to it.
Yeah.
And check out Serenity. And let your kids see Serenity. Teach them what a terrible movie is like. Yeah.
There's other terrible movies you can start them out with.
Hey, 8-year-old, that's Matthew McConaughey's thrusty sex butt. Oh, sex? Here, I'll explain what that is, too.
Sometimes when a man and a woman are really bored in a muggy island...
they decide to make themselves even sweatier. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. The Wife.
Oh, yes.
Hey, you guys, we finally saw The Wife.
We're doing some Oscar catch-up.
Months behind.
I know. We still got to watch.
When did that get released?
Oh, gosh.
September?
Yeah, that's October. Early in the fall.
Yeah.
And that was the first screener we got in the mail, too.
It was.
Yeah.
And I looked at it, and I thought, maybe I'll get to that one, I suppose. I don't know. I like Glenn Close. She's terrific.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she started winning awards, and now she's nominated for an Academy Award. And I want to talk about her nomination.
Now that we've seen the movie.
Now that we've seen this film. This is the "We're sorry we haven't given you an Oscar yet" nomination.
Pretty much. And if she wins, it'll be the oops.
"We're sorry we didn't give you an Oscar before this."
Yeah.
So here, have an Oscar.
Won't you?
This film is whatever, and your performance is everything we've ever seen from you before now.
Yeah.
But here, it's your turn to have an Oscar.
And as somebody pointed out, you know, in the same way that Maggie Smith won an Oscar for California Suite for playing a woman who lost an Oscar.
Yes.
This is Glenn Close playing a woman who's supposed to be getting an award.
Right. Here's what's going on in this movie. Glenn Close is married to Jonathan Pryce.
Yes.
Jonathan Pryce is a highly respected...
man of letters.
Yeah. He's an author who is... described as having changed the course of contemporary literary fiction.
Right. Like Philip Rothy, I guess.
Okay, sure.
With some John Updike thrown in, I don't know.
They describe him as being a person who has sort of reshaped the culture. Like, he's a big deal.
Right. Yeah. But they also make a point to, like, talk about his Jewishness and how he's worked that into the books.
Right.
And
yeah.
So I always, my go-to for that is always Philip
Rothy. He's such a success that they own a big fancy house.
Right.
Now, everyone I know who's a writer is poor.
Well, and so, he's like a best-selling author. And,
that's
you know,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, they at one point they talk about how like the Arabic translation of his first novel paid for like their beach house or something.
Yeah.
He's that level.
It's back in the that's know. Like that's old school.
Yeah, this is also this
I
begins
get, I make a living, a really nice living from writing books.
This movie begins in 1992 or 96.
92. Yes.
Yeah. So, like, clearly he's a 50s, 60s sort of literary lion.
Right. All I'm saying is that you and I have three books between us. Thank God for the rent control in this apartment.
Uh-huh.
So, So opening scene, he gets the phone call. He has won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Right.
Off they go to Stockholm with their adult son.
Yes.
Played by Max Irons.
Right.
Who, if he looks somewhat familiar, it's because his father is Jeremy Irons.
Who put Glenn Close into a coma in Reversal of Fortune.
Correct. I thought I was about to get one kind of movie.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a whole other kind of movie.
Yes.
We learn over the course of the film that this is not an intimate, quiet character study of a woman who has sacrificed a lot and, you know,
endured
things and stood by the side of a problematic man. Instead, we are treated to the...
Is this a spoiler?
It is a spoiler, and I think it's important that we talk about it.
Okay. If you don't want to know what happens in The Wife, skip ahead a few minutes.
It's not like a giant twist. It's a slow reveal.
Yeah.
that you could actually probably piece together bit by bit if you felt like it while you're watching the film.
Sure.
You come to the understanding over the course of the movie that she's the one writing the books.
Yeah.
She's not just his proofreader. She's not just the in-home editor. She's the one who's sitting there
at the typewriter.
At the typewriter writing these books. And the reason she's doing this is because she learns early on in life in the 50s that a lady writer,
Elizabeth McGovern,
is not going to be taken seriously. And Elizabeth McGovern, who is a lady writer,
yeah,
tells her this.
Yeah.
And while I understand that is a true thing,
mm-hmm,
particularly 60, you know, years ago, I also think that it makes the movie a little cheesy. Because what would become a universal story about the lives that women have lived in relationship to husbands,
mm-hmm,
becomes a specific, you know, occasion for one woman's justifiable rage.
Right.
Because in history, how often has this happened? Well, we don't know.
We don't know.
And possibly it has. But
it's the same setup we get in Vice, really, with Lynn Cheney,
right,
realizing that she's ambitious, she's smart, she's never going to get these doors open to her because she's a woman, so she's going to prop up this doofus to do it for her.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing here, because, like, Glenn Close's character, and young Glenn Close is played by her own daughter,
right,
is working at a publishing house, and they're like, oh, we need a Philip Roth, we need a Jewish writer. And so she brings her husband's manuscript, and they hate it.
Yeah.
Or no, she reads it and says it's not good enough.
Yes.
And so basically, she writes a thing that he has some input in, and they love that.
Right.
And that becomes his first novel.
Now, hear me clearly. I'm not saying that no woman could ever, you know, pull one over like that. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the movie had the opportunity to be something more subtle and smart, and instead, it became almost a whodunit.
Well, yeah. I mean, it, the way, like you said, it does have this slow build. It becomes this weird sort of, like, gotcha twist.
Yeah.
Like M. Night Shyamalan's The Wife, you know?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Like that. So I think this is ultimately a pretty mediocre film.
Yeah.
With a really good performance by Glenn Close.
Yes, no question.
Who deserves her nomination, but who is not given the opportunity to do much other than what you know she can do.
Yeah. There's a lot of...
And I wish that if she is going to win an Academy Award, that it was for a better movie.
Yeah.
That gave her something meatier, something smarter, something along the lines of what Yalitza Aparicio is doing,
sure,
in Roma, which is a very quiet and very contained performance, the kind the Academy isn't super into.
Right. And I bet if you look at the winners in this category, in the Best Actor, Best Actress category, a lot of times you get people who are in movies that are otherwise kind of negligible. Like, she's the only nomination for The Wife.
Yes.
You know, but it's a performance, it's a standout, usually from somebody who's been doing it for a long time that they hadn't really gotten around to acknowledging. Like Gary Oldman in The Darkest Hour. Like, Jessica Lange in Blue Sky. You know, there's a lot of examples, I think, where it's just this one big powerhouse thing in a film that barely knows how to support it. And, yeah, she's the only thing really in this movie that's notable.
Absolutely. You know, it looks nice.
Yeah.
It's very handsome, polished.
Right. Like Christian Slater has an interesting supporting performance as this sort of, like, sycophant.
A bad penny.
Yeah, who keeps turning up.
Yeah.
I know you don't like this movie nearly as much as I do, but I thought the Tamsin Grieg character in Tamara Drew was a more interesting examination of a, sort of, you know, wife of the great man of letters,
right,
character, who in turn I think also is doing a lot of the actual writing herself as well.
Yes.
But less sort of on the nose than the wife is.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're catching up like we did.
Yeah.
And you want to watch a good Glenn Close performance, you'll be bored by the wife.
We've still got to watch At Eternity's Gates.
And you'll be into Glenn Close.
Yes.
Yeah, we also have to catch up on At Eternity's Gate for that film's one nomination.
Yes. Yeah.
Look, I might not even watch the Academy Awards this year. So, you know.
You know what? This is a year to skip. If they're gonna really do that not presenting best cinematography thing, you know, yeah, boycott. What the hell?
Yeah. I mean, you're not even going to be in town. You won't watch them at all because you're going to be working.
I won't be working. I'm sure. I can't imagine there's going to be that much going on. I mean, I'll be at a film festival, but I'm sure they're not going to try and counter-program the Oscars.
You don't think?
I don't know. It's a several week-long festival, so if they wanted to take a night off, it wouldn't be the end of the world. You know? We'll see.
And now, I have finally caught up on Stan and Ollie.
Yes.
Now, you're going to be talking very in-depth about that on this week's episode of Who Shot You.
That is true.
And you've already talked about it once on this show, so we're not going to waste a whole lot of time.
Yeah. So why don't you talk about what you thought about it? I'm
just
a fan.
Just to recap, it's the story of Oliver Hardy and Stan Laurel in the later years.
Yes.
As their film careers have sort of hit a post-World War II slump.
Right.
Which I think is sort of a missed opportunity on the film's part to explore what happened to film stars who were big deals before the war, and then after the war, the national mood looking kind of collectively to the future left a lot of those people behind.
Well, I think in this specific case, it had more to do with the fact that they were aging and they were physical comedians, and so that's always uncomfortable to watch, like that last Lucille Ball show, you know. You know, and I think that really had more to do with it. Than, I mean, I know what you're saying. There is a larger statement to be made about the changing tastes, but I think that specifically it was about them getting older and working less often.
Right. So they go to England, they're doing a tour of small theaters, they're hoping to get production money for a movie they want to do. It's all sort of falling apart, no one's coming to see them at the little theaters.
The music halls.
And their relationship has become, they never have a falling out, really. They just have that kind of relationship where they've known each other for decades and decades and decades, and they are inextricably linked.
Right.
And sometimes they don't always want to be.
Yeah. And there are grudges and old wounds they are nursing.
Yeah. They, eventually, you know, realize that they are stuck with each other and they're not unhappy about it. It's not like they're Lou Abbott and Lou Costello and Bud Abbott.
Bud Abbott.
Who at one point, Stan Laurel walks by a giant movie poster for Abbott and Costello.
Right.
And sort of wistfully looks at it like, okay, that's... Yeah.
They're the new guys.
They're the new guys here. But Abbott and Costello hated each other.
Yeah.
Martin and Lewis, they hated each other. So I'm kind of glad that this wasn't a movie about that kind of thing.
Right.
Like, I do like the idea that, no, I'm working with my best friend. And we're going to stay best friends even if we drive each other crazy and even if we fight sometimes.
Right.
And so there's that. And I did appreciate that. I also appreciated the performances by Steve Coogan and...
Oh, yeah.
John
C. Reilly.
John C. Reilly as Laurel and Hardy. Riley's in a whole bunch of prosthetic everything.
Yeah.
And
very convincingly
looks
so.
More like Oliver Hardy than John C. Reilly, frankly.
Mm.
I thought they were wonderful. I thought Nina Arianda and Shirley Henderson as their wives were, I could have watched an entire film about them.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Their performances are great.
They
as
are
well.
A comic duo under
this
themselves.
Movie got zero Oscar attention.
Nope.
And you know they released it at this time of year hoping that that was what was going to happen.
Oh, yeah. It opened this past weekend right after the nominations came out with the thought that, well, surely
there'll be some nominations and now we're going to open wide or wider. How many theaters is it in this week?
It's
1,000 maybe?
Probably, yeah. But I mean, like, not even makeup, which I'm astonished because, yeah you're right. John C. Reilly looks amazingly like Oliver Hardy.
Yeah. So, if you go see this, and it is playing wider now, so you might have the opportunity. Not as irritatingly as The Wife, I would say. But the film is a lot of missed opportunities to explore the idea of post-war sensibilities, to explore the idea of what happens to a famous person when their fame begins to fade, and how they deal with that in their lives, and what it means to be famous and then not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas about when other people are in control of your fate, because they do open up the film with the idea, with this subject, this is a plot point.
Yeah.
They want to own their own product.
The way that Chaplin and Harold Lloyd did.
Yeah. Those guys owned their own stuff, and then eventually Lucille Ball owned her own thing.
Yeah.
And so they never got that gig.
That cachet.
They never had the opportunity to own their own material. And so they had to keep working because they had to keep an income coming. And right. other people were in control of that.
Hal Roach,
other studios, fans, you know. So I would really like a better movie to support these four very good performances.
I don't know. I think a lot of the stuff that you're talking about is in there. Like, they don't maybe stop and dwell on it, but I think they touch upon it, and those are topics that the film is covering.
It does. It's got a lot more invested in their interpersonal interactions on a day-by-day basis. And here's a question I have. Did they really do bits in public when no one was looking?
Because
that's what the film suggests.
Yeah.
That, for an audience of one, they would happily start doing a bit.
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, because they are such sort of old school. It's not like today's comedians where, like, you approach them on the street and they're just like, leave me alone.
Right.
You know, I think they had that sort of old school vaudevillian, like, they would just turn it on like that. And you would see, like, you know, like, I totally believe that when, for example, there's a scene where Stan Laurel is stuck in this waiting room, waiting to meet with this producer who's been blowing him off, and there's the one girl receptionist, and he starts, like, taking his hat off and, you know, scratching the top of his head and doing that shtick. Like, I totally bought that, yes, he would do that, A, because he was bored, B, because he was trying to curry favor, and C, because he had an audience.
Right.
So, yeah, I would say yes.
It's fine. It's better than The Wife.
It is. I'll tell you.
But if you're all about the performances, if actors are your thing and you want to see actors doing what you love seeing them do, then Stan and Ollie is fine and The Wife is fine.
I think part of what I like so much about Stan and Ollie is so many of the ways that it could have gone wrong. Because I think we've seen so many movies that are about, like, as you said, comedy teams who hated each other, or, like, really maudlin stories about comedians, but who are really, you know, like, sad clowns on the inside.
Right.
And then also, like, for a movie to take on this particular duo and to have two contemporary actors reenacting some of their most famous bits, that could have gone south in a heartbeat. Like, that could have just been like, ugh, I'm not buying this. This is wrong. They don't get it. The timing is off. They're not funny. Coogan and Reilly, like, every time they do an old school Laurel and Hardy bit, do that bit to perfection.
Right.
It's like watching a recreation. And so it's like, okay. So I think, you know, I might be too kind to the movie just because I think it avoids so many of the pitfalls that I projected it going into. But I think it deserves points for avoiding those pitfalls. So,
okay. I almost agree with you.
Fair enough. Do you have a DVD pick?
An El Septimo Dia.
Ah, yes. Adam McKay. Not Adam McKay. Jim McKay.
We talked about this last week when Manola and Robert and Peter were here.
Uh-huh.
Briefly, but we talked about it.
Yeah.
It's about an undocumented man in New York City who is facing a minor crisis, but one that has repercussions.
Right.
He works in a restaurant. He's moving his way up. They want to maybe put him in the front of the house. He keeps asking for that, and the owner keeps kind of brushing him off, which means it might not happen at all. He also plays on a very accomplished neighborhood soccer team. They're in the championships, and suddenly, and without warning, the boss of the restaurant says, "Oh, hey, I need you Sunday because a client's daughter's fourth birthday party." I don't even know exactly what it was. Someone's kid's birthday party is happening here. He's like, no, I have Sundays off and I play on the soccer team. You can't do that. He's like, no, you have to come in. And he's like, no, but we're in the championship. And the guy's like, well, then you're fired if you don't come in. He needs this job because he's trying to bring his girlfriend up from Mexico. And it becomes the most wonderful sort of, very much like the kid who would be king, people banding together to try to trick the owner of the restaurant. And I will not spoil the ending. But it is a wonderful film. It got a tiny little release last year, and it's finally on DVD and Blu-ray.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I need to see it.
About how crappy it is to have a job.
Mine is Laurel and Hardy, The Ultimate Collection. It's like a 10 discs or something insane. 6 discs, I forget. But it's got like a lot of the shorts, some of the features.
Right.
So if Stan and Ollie have sort of whet your appetite for this classic comedy duo, you should go watch more of their stuff because they're really great. And we have some letters, but we don't really have time this week, unfortunately. But maybe we won't put them on the spoiler episode. But we'll get to them next time.
Right.
Anyway, hey, do you know we have a Patreon?
We do. It's very exciting for you. Let me explain it to everyone.
Oh, please do.
All these different levels of subscription. Do you like this show? Do you want to hear more? Do you want a mug or a t-shirt? so many choices and opportunities for you to enjoy these things. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and you'll find a level of subscription that works for you. And now, there's a new level. One that I've been wanting to do for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
Because originally the levels began at $4 a month.
Right.
Which comes out to, and I'm always prorating things like this in my head, $1 a week for the podcast LKTV, which is a podcast of television.
Mm-hmm.
And there's $7 a month for Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yes.
And on and on and on with various levels of excitement and surprises and private podcasts where you choose the topic. But now there's the dollar a month level. And at the dollar a month level, you get a thing that we're now calling LKRX, like a prescription. Where every day, every weekday, we tell you a thing that we love. And we prescribe it to you.
No.
A cultural object. It's sort of like every day a DVD, pick.
Yeah.
But not a DVD.
Necessarily.
Sometimes a DVD. But mostly a lot of just things in the culture that we are into that don't always fit into the format of a film podcast or a TV podcast. Or a food podcast. So, I like this level because it's super cheap. Also, you get this big sticker that the $4 and $7 people got last year. And we're working on this situation where we can even get maybe a video to post. If we can get it like protected with a password.
That's
we're trying to
here
sort that out. That's like a... That's the dream of the dollar level. But right now, the dollar level is you get a daily dose of us telling you what to do with your life.
Yes, and who doesn't want that?
Yeah, I recommend it. It's incredibly cheap. That's 25 cents a week.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm worth 25 cents.
I think.
A week. I think.
Yes.
It's you $20 people I don't understand. I'll never feel worthy of you.
Bless your hearts.
But the, all of the best. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I love all of you.
Of course.
That's Patreon.
And that's our time. I would run through our friends' podcast, but I got a skedaddle, so I'm just going to say like us on all the places that we stream, like Stitcher and Spotify and Google Play and Podbean. You can leave us that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to us for free. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Follow him and his adventures at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. We're going to try and be back this week with spoilers of Serenity and Glass, because there's a lot to unpack there. But anyway...
I don't know that there's a lot to unpack. There's just a lot to mock.
Potato, potato.
All right.
Until next time.
Goodbye.